Hi there. This is Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett, Empower Radio. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate you for tuning in. Hope you're having a good time wherever you are, whatever you're doing, and you're open-minded. This is one of my favorite things about doing this show. I get to talk from people from all walks of life, people who are dabbling or investigating, exploring in the world, mostly of metaphysics. That's my, I really enjoy that area. And since my life has had all of these quirky little tangents, it's nice to talk to other people who've gone through the same thing, or at least talk to other people who've gone through the same thing. Brent Rains is the guy behind Alternate Perceptions magazine. He has quite a history, too. He's the editor of the magazine. It's been online since 2002, but he was doing it in various incarnations before that. And what, in the 70s you started publishing this?
Well, I had some other newsletters, but this one actually began back in 85 as a... It had a different name at the time. It was a small, like, four-page newsletter. At times I Xeroxed it. Other times I mimeographed it, you know. And this was, the days before we had the World Wide Web going up full steam ahead, you know, and could get on the Internet and do all these marvelous things that we do today.
Oh, and this is, but, yeah, I know. This has made it a whole lot easier. I love it because when I don't know how I found it. It's just, you know, that surfing thing and putting in different headlines. But it was such a nice connection. And then when I realized that you had all this other background, you wrote for Fate Magazine, Recovery Times, and you are also involved in writing a chapter with, I guess, Dr. Schwartz, UFO Dynamics, and Greg Little's.
Right, and I've got two of my own books. I've written forward and afterwards to two of Dr. Greg Little's book, People of the Web and Grand Illusions. Greg is actually Greg Little of Memphis. He's a nationally certified psychologist, author of quite a number of books on mental health and Native American ancient sites. He's written an encyclopedia, an illustrated encyclopedia of Native American mounds and earthworks, which is very comprehensive. And it covers every state in the U.S., places that, you know, anyone could go through or plan a vacation, you know, or go to places in their own state, you know. And
you've given tours. You've given the just, you know, to interrupt
you
for a second.
Ohio and Georgia. And my wife has also been a co-leader along with Greg and Laura Little. We've gone on two Ohio Mounds tours. We've visited all the neat sites up there, like Serpent Mound and a site at Newark that probably a lot of people don't know about, but there's this huge earthen circle with a wall around it and a ditch that's, you know, like 30 acres or more, and with these ancient causeways that apparently long ago connected with another site down in Chillicothe with many burial mounds and ceremonial sites, and it's like, I think, 50 miles, and they believe that there were these ceremonies. They charted the movements of the stars and kept up with the eclipses and moon cycles, and they were deep into astronomy, and they were very, very educated. You know, we think of Indians as being backward, ignorant, savage people, you know. All they did was go around and get into skirmishes and things, and the evidence actually points to the fact that these people actually had backgrounds that involved a lot of things that we're just now sort of rediscovering ourselves, you know, in the realm of the paranormal and consciousness. And so, of course, you know, it's unfortunate that so much of it has been hidden, and so many of these ancient sites have been plowed over, you know, and lost to us. But
it's kind of our version of the pyramids.
Yeah, I mean, there's places here in America where people just don't realize how marvelous they are. And the reason the Newark site is actually still preserved is because they made a golf course out of it. And, you know, the big circle and the causeways and everything, they make great places for golfing. So we've been there twice, though. It's an extremely incredible site. There's one that part of it still survives around Portsmouth, Ohio, along the Ohio River. And it was what's unique about this is a causeway that goes several miles from the Kentucky side over into Portsmouth, Ohio, up on this hill, and there were these ceremonial sites up there, and then it went in another direction back across into Kentucky, further on down the river to another huge site with all these earthen walls. As part of it still remains, we still don't know exactly what they did, but there was obviously significant ceremonies. But the sleeping prophet, Edgar Cayce, reason Greg and Laura got interested in it was that there was a, you know, he mentioned about the fact that some of the Indians, like the Iroquois, had the DNA of some of the original people from Atlantis, you know, and that there were remnants of some of the replicas to be found within these sites of the ancient Atlantean realm. And actually, this site near Portsmouth had a place that had like these three canals around a central mound that also had these causeways going in like four different directions. One which extended way out to the Ohio River and up the embankment into what is now modern Portsmouth, and that was several miles long. And that description fits the center city of Atlantis, you know, as described by Plato. It could have been a replica, you know, the central mound, temple mound, and then the three circular waterways around it, or trenches, and then the causeways going out in the different directions, four different directions. And when we actually went on tour, I mean, sometimes we've had people who've had some incredible psychic experiences too. We've done these meditations, and we have replicas of the Peruvian whistling vessels, which are pre-Columbian whistles that were used by spiritual practitioners, shamans, and were actually quite popular, I think, back in the day, back in Peru, going back 2,000 or so years. And they were used in just about all the different cultures, and they emit high-pitched frequencies, and blown together, a set of them, you get all these different frequencies combining, causing these harmonic frequencies. And people today, we've done sessions with them ourselves, with people, and I've talked to the original discoverers of the, you know, who first discovered and started experimenting with the whistles again, with and they describe, people describe again and again these altered states that they enter. I've even experienced some of this myself, and we've had one time, Dr. Greg Little was one of the people with me. In fact, I was over at his house, and it was Andrew Collins from England, well-known author, historian, author of The Cygnus Mystery and Gods of Eden, and also has been into UFOs through the years. We did a session with the whistles a few years ago when he was visiting from England, and Andrew and Greg, myself, and another gentleman from the Memphis, Tennessee area, all of us described this whirling vortex, and we all saw it a little differently, but it was all four of us, as swirling in the same direction too. And you know, we got to thinking, what were the odds of that, you know?
And where was the vortex? Was this in a group, like a meditation or a seance, or how did that happen?
It was simply, we were out on the water. Greg and Laura lived on a lake there in Memphis, and we were out on a pontoon, a group of us, and we thought this would, you know, the sun was going down. It was very peaceful, a beautiful day, and we just thought we would go ahead and we'd been discussing, I've been telling them about the whistles and their history, and Andrew already seemed to know quite a bit about it, and said they, you know, let's go ahead and give it a try. And so we did, and Greg had never, you know, he'd been around me with the whistles before, never had an experience before, but he did this time. And it was pretty impressive. We've had people that had described even like out-of-body experiences, visions, seeing, suddenly finding themselves in an ancient Mayan village or something, you know. And so it's quite interesting. UCLA had studied, I think, 73 of these vessels back in the 70s. It was Daniel Stakhanov back in 1972 who first discovered their, what he calls their psychoacoustical properties. And he lived in Pennsylvania and was at an auction, and he was really looking for something else to make money on, colonial American antiques. And someone just happened to have one of these pre-Columbian whistling vessels there, and he thought he would go ahead and, what the heck, buy it. It might have some dollar value. He got it really dirt cheap. And a few weeks later, he's home alone, just sitting there in his den, and he thought, well, let's take a look at this vase. And had a little spout on it, and he blew in it, made this whistling sound. And the next thing he knows, contrary to any previous experience he had, he was not a New Ager. He, or anything like that, no metaphysical bone in his body, he didn't think. But suddenly it was like he was flying through space. And, you know, like a Star Trek moment. And mm-hmm. he's going towards this dark cloud. And this really bothers him. And next thing he knows, he, you know, doesn't want to go into this dark area. And then suddenly he's out of it. He's covered in sweat. And he looks down at his vessel and he realizes, I've got to go on a journey to find out what this is all about. He starts going to museums and talking with people and finds out nobody really understands what these whistles are. There were single chamber, double chamber, I think four chambers, even a few that's more chambers than that. They are effigy. Generally, they're effigy whistles. They have, you know, like figures of animals or birds or people, you know, on them. And he talked about going into a museum in New York to find out more about it. And the guy, you know, said, oh, they were just to carry water, and that's all. And he opened up a door to a back room, and there were shelves full of these faces, he said, looking back at him, you know. And he realized no one really understood these that well, and he went out to California and got some people at a sound lab at UCLA interested in studying them, and gathered up about 73 of the whistles, and they put hoses to them and put a continuous stream of air through them and measured on instruments the sounds, and I think there was some of them that gave up to as many as 7 harmonic frequencies.
Wow.
And, yeah. Just, you know. And
for
so
just
he
to
was
carry
really,
water, that's a little overkill.
Yeah.
Very musical.
Yeah, he said it was much more involved. And then, of course, as you study all the different cultures and religions, and I mean, Central America, you know, different parts of the world, sound, and of course Tibetan Buddhist, you find that sound is important. You got your you know, singing bowls and bells, and sound is very important to you know, spiritual evolution,
absolutely,
conditioning,
yeah,
meditation. And so this was a significant part of it, but I think it's only a part of it. I've been reading some, you know, where there was some research being done in Central America of a lot of different kind of effigy whistling vessels down there. And so this thing is still wide open for further exploration.
Well, see, that's the deal about it. You can find all of these relics and all of these little pieces of pottery, whatever it is. And until we have the context, a person, the people that go with that to tell you the story, it's just conjecture. And especially if you're trying to apply our assumption that they didn't know much more than just what a nomadic and illiterate society might know. And that's extremely arrogant and totally wrong.
Right.
You're going to just come up with a whole bunch of stuff that has nothing to do with reality.
But it's, you know, it's interesting. It seems like that the more more we find out, at least it seems that way to me, the more that we're actually rediscovering what a lot of ancient people already realized and knew, and we're just sort of like rediscovering, you know, surprisingly, things that, hey, you know, they were already on that. They were already exploring that, you know, and the Native American cultures, the things that emerge from that and other cultures globally, when you take really a comprehensive global and historical perspective on a lot of the things that, well, like near-death experiences, there's a whole area. There was a study done back in the 70s, Carlos Osis, and another researcher, I can't remember his name now, but they wrote an extensive book dealing with near-death experiences, and they had gathered a lot of these reports from India over around that region and compared them to reports from the United States. And, you know, if you just, you know, like the context of the experiencer here in the U.S. feeling it was, you know, sort of a biblical description, angel, Christ figure, as opposed to Buddha, you know, from the East. Essentially, it was all the same, you know.
Well, and that, I think, has to do with the context that we're given as we are socialized, that we're going to describe it. And this is putting a blanket analogy to it, so it can be, there's exceptions. But we're going to describe it with the language that we have been taught or we've been socialized to. And so when you're growing up and saying Buddha, or you're saying Allah, or you're saying God, then that's, for the most part, how we have a, you know, a template or a frame of reference. And the fascinating thing is that the parallels, no matter what name is attached, the experience often is that uplifting, beyond words, feeling of being one or something, part of something bigger than this reality that we're currently experiencing. And I think that's where we all are headed in this evolution of consciousness. At least that's what I'm experiencing.
And it's disturbing the way that we have taken this information in from positive experiences and spiritual paranormal experiences down through the ages. We've kind of naturally we digest it as best we can, and then it gets incorporated into culture and various contexts that, you know, evolve from there. And then suddenly we got people killing other people in the name of religion, you know, and it takes on a negative connotation.
Well, I like, in terms of the magazine that you have, Alternate Perceptions Magazine, if you're listening, and you can check this out at apmagazine.info on the web, and you can find all sorts of stories. The one that I really, really enjoyed, and I wrote a letter to you about saying thank you, was the one on Kreskin. And as a part of a radio team, we interviewed, I think in the mid-70s, we interviewed Mr. The Amazing, he likes to be known, The Amazing Kreskin. And he was so just very kind, very shy, quiet, reserved, and, he doesn't divulge anything when you're around him. But so reading your story and having the benefit of some of this, you know, his stuff about being a kid and how he came up with this and all that, I really enjoyed it. Can you share a bit of your experience and how that came about?
Sure. Well, for a little over three decades, I had met a couple times and corresponded extensively with Dr. Berthold Schwartz, who was a psychiatrist who went back into the 50s, had studied extensively paranormal phenomena, and he studied a lot of people who had seemed to have developed abilities to do telepathic, you know, telepathic type things, telekinetic type things on occasion. And, you know, he was very interested in trying to document and even observe and do experiments into those kind of areas. And so I had a good connection. In fact, he wrote a lot of articles for Alternate Perceptions, many times with more photographs than we could use. And Also, I tried to do, you know, early on, have a regular interview feature, and he was always very helpful. He knew just about everybody in the field, you know, the current field and people who've been in it for for a long time. And Kreskin was one of those people that he brought up, said, you know, I know this man. I can put you in touch. I think he'd make a great interview. And I certainly wasn't going to disagree with him on that. He had steered me in the right direction. And as I mentioned to you earlier, Amazing Kreskin was someone that for a number of years that I had secretly wanted to meet. And I've never actually met him, but we had a great interview on the telephone. And so he had suggested in advance a number of things that I should talk with him about. And actually, before the interview, you know, I mentioned some of the things that I wanted to discuss with Kreskin about, you know, by correspondence. He agreed. We set up a date and a time, and we had us quite a conversation, and went back to his childhood memories of when he first became aware that he had this ability to be able to, like, find objects that someone had hidden in a room. And he called it the hot and cold thing that a lot of us did as kids, you know, like, are you getting hot, you're getting cold, you know, and he seemed very adept at it, and could go right to something that someone had hidden, and not just, you know, like the general area. I mean, he would find it, like, reach right exactly where it was. And of course, through the years, he found that he had this ability. When he does performances, he said that he, in order to get paid, and it sounds real risky, I would go broke, but they have to, they hide the check that he gets paid with somewhere in the auditorium, wherever he's performing, and he doesn't get paid unless he finds it.
And see, that was always fascinating to me, how he did that. He would go on Johnny Carson or whatever. I think, was it Bob Hope at one time who said he was looking at the chandelier, trying not to telegraph it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he suddenly found himself, they had a turkey there, and he suddenly found himself rolling his sleeves up, took his coat off, and plunged into the turkey, and he didn't even know why he was doing it himself. And, you know, and then he's telling about there was someone that he was told that he was going to have to find in New York City, and this one person.
Yes.
And he
yes.
did it. He did it in record time.
Well, and they even had a trick there, because it was a building that had a hidden floor.
Right. He was going up in the elevator, and you know, he got really disturbed and pounded his fist on the wall, got frustrated, and went down, and then looked up at the building and realized, okay. There is, because, you know, he said, I've messed it up, because there's supposed to be another floor here. And then looking at it, he says, oh, okay, the elevator went there, but you got to get out and walk over to the, you know, walk up the stairs.
Yeah, see, that's what is so brilliant. I mean, that he has both the wherewithal when you're in that situation of being totally demoralized, thinking, I am way off base, I'm totally wrong. But then to think it through and go, oh, no, look, here. He had a lot of common sense just to put himself back upright and figure out why the math wasn't adding up.
Right.
But he's a very fascinating person.
Oh, yes. And he said in the interview that, you know, if he hadn't realized he had this ability and played with it in his real young years, that he'd probably be like most people and never have developed it, because he would have got old enough and, you know, just dismissed it, saying it can't be done, and therefore,
okay,
you know, it wouldn't have been done.
Well, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back, but I want to ask some of the top interviews you've had over the years, because you have had a chance to talk with a lot of really fascinating people. We're talking with Brent Raines. He is basically the big honcho at AP Magazine, Alternate Perceptions Magazine online. And we'll be back with more on Empower Radio. I'm Wendy Garrett, and this is Conscious Living.
up in the sky.
It's just a leaf.
It's the SmartWay Leaf. The SmartWay Leaf tells you what cars and trucks are certified as better for the environment.
A talking leaf?
No, it's a logo leaf. You know, leaf, the environment.
Why not an acorn? It says environment, you can squirrel away acorns.
Well, the leaf works better with a tagline. America is turning over a new leaf for the environment. SmartWay leaves will be raining down all over the country.
Yeah, you wouldn't want acorns raining down on people's heads. That would hurt.
Go to www.epa.gov/smartway.
I like
change a light bulb, save some green. Just replace traditional light bulbs with energy-efficient bulbs and fixtures. If you're like most people, 20% of your home electric bills go directly to lighting. Every light we switch to one bearing the government's Energy Star label uses at least two-thirds less energy than older bulbs. Such a light will save more than $30 in energy costs over its lifetime. Brighten your environmental future. From the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
Confessions of a Potentially Perfect Parent, brought to you by AdoptUsKids.org.
I know more about cooking dinner for a party of 12 than about packing a lunch for a 12-year-old. I know kids like things like fish sticks. Filets, I get, but sticks? Maybe we can just compromise on mac and cheese. Can you make that with Brie?
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who would love to put up with you. Call 1-888-200-4005 or visit AdoptUsKids.org for more information. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
Conscious Living on Empower Radio. Hi there, I'm Wendy Garrett. Thanks for tuning in. I really enjoy talking to people who've had the opportunity to do interviews with, you know, sometimes life-changing people and personalities like the amazing Kreskin. The guy has such a gift, and I would never have thought that other people could do it until I started realizing we're all doing it in different ways. And you're right. He developed it. Brent Rains, one of the interviews he did was with the amazing Kreskin in one of the recent issues of Alternate Perceptions magazine. And I was so thrilled because even though that we had him on as a guest in a radio interview, you just barely scratch the surface with a guy like that. And he's not going to give you all of his information or his clues to what he's doing in one sitting. You kind of have to develop a relationship. So you got to talk with him over the phone and you got to find out a little bit more about his background. But he's not the only one. You've had years of experiences and connections and interviews with some very fascinating people. Can you highlight a few for us?
Well, you put me on the spot there. It's hard because, you know, there've been a lot of good ones, and I'll throw some out there. I interviewed Edgar Mitchell, who was the sixth man to walk on the moon back in the early 70s, the Apollo mission, and he had sort of a, you know, he was doing a, he'd gotten interested in the paranormal and wanted to do a experiment from space. And a telepathy experiment. In the process, on his return flight, he had like this feeling of like a mystical experience of oneness, of being connected with everything. And he was very interested in that experience and wanted to get into it even further. And after he came back, he soon was involved in with Stanford Research Institute, studying psychic phenomena in the laboratory, Uri Geller, the metal bender from Israel, and other people with abilities. He even tested children who had this, you know, could do the Geller effect, hold a spoon or fork in their hands and it would bend. And he said he observed this and he was convinced it was not trickery, that it was real. And then he also talked with me a little about quantum physics and his thoughts on that. And after the interview, I told my wife, I says, you know, this is really interesting. You know, for years, early in my research, going back to the 60s, you know, I was called a lot of things, you know, being out there and into the fringe. And I said, here's a man, an American hero, an astronaut. He's very intelligent. He has a scientific background. And he sounds just as flaky as me. I love it.
Well, and just a little background. I talked with one of the guys who was a manager, booking agent for Uri Geller. And he said whenever he went over to his house, his experience was that, that even the spoons in the cupboard were, or in the drawers, were bent. Whatever that
well, you
talent
know, I,
was.
And I should mention I interviewed Uri Geller one time, too. And he's pretty easy to contact. You know, I just emailed him and said I'd like to talk with you sometime. And we set up a time, and I called him. And, you know, we talked a while, and I think I had a, some interruption occurred, and I had to call back again and talk with him. But, you know, he told me all, a lot of the things that, you know, him and Buhart had experienced that first time that they had met, some of the strange paranormal things, the tape recorder with the voice coming out of it. And he said he was really skeptical. He tore the tape recorder apart himself, tried to find some, you know, hidden speaker in there, something that was, you know, a receiver that was doing it, never could explain it. He described seeing the spaceships in the desert, you know, they had those, the UFO encounters. He said it was, you know, it was quite real. And so that was another interesting interview. I've interviewed Andrew Collins from England. I mentioned him earlier, meeting him over at Greg and Laura Little's over in Memphis. And Andrew's written quite a number of books dealing with ancient civilizations, with Atlantis. And he's also written a book recently called Light Quest, which deals with the UFO phenomena, which he's also been involved with for several decades now.
Well, and the other one is the Cygnus Mystery.
Right, the Cygnus Mystery, which he realized when he was at an ancient site, I think it was about 10,000 years old over in Turkey, that it had an alignment with Cygnus, the star system Cygnus, toward the north. And he began to look at, you know, other sites around the world and realized, man, there's Cygnus connections all over. And a lot of the legends about this celestial bird in the north, a cosmic bird, and the sound that it would emit, which he also thought was interesting in connection with the whistles, and how they felt that a lot of cultures that, you know, when they died, their soul would go back to this ancient realm, to this, you know, connected it with Cygnus. And when he came, you know, to the United States to visit Greg and Laura, they would often get in the car and go off to these ancient sites up in Ohio and Georgia and down in Texas and find a lot of correlation, further correlations to this Cygnus thing as well. So, personally, I was on a quest one time. We used to have a sweat lodge behind the house here, and I had a feeling there was a site that I needed to go to down in Alabama that I'd been told by our sweat lodge leader about, where I had the petroglyph. And I said, there's a symbol there that's key to something I need to understand further. And I didn't know what it was when I went there at the time, but at the next sweat, it came to me, and it was the bird's foot that I had seen at this site down in Alabama called Kinloch Shelter, which is in the Bankhead Forest. And, yeah, you can hear my dog bark in the background.
Yeah,
about
that's okay. I've got, yeah, it's okay.
But anyway, there was another site we went to that day as well with petroglyphs, and we did some meditating and all, and a lot of people got, including my wife, had some pretty powerful experiences. In fact, my wife has seen, like, energy, this, you know, energy fields or whatever you want to call them, auras, ever since that day. You know, we'll be going somewhere. A lot of times we'll be at other ancient sites, sacred sites, and she will see these things. And so it started that day. And for me, I got the words Southern Cross. Well, it turns out that there is a connection between the Cygnus Cross and another star cluster that's called, sort of like the twin, which is called the Southern Cross. And it's more visible in the lower hemisphere, like in Peru. They talk about both the crosses and how some people go to the Northern Cross when they die and some people go to the Southern Cross. And I didn't know anything about all this, but then when I met Andrew Collins over at Greg, he hadn't come out with his book yet, Cygnus Mystery, but as I was listening to him and as he was showing me the illustrations, I realized, man, this illustration of what this this star that's shooting these cosmic rays at us from light years away, that looks like what I saw in my vision, you know. And I got the Southern Cross, and, you know, it took me a while to put it all together, but I thought, man, that was quite an interesting cluster of hits there on that.
Well, and that's what I wanted to ask in terms of the people that you've spoken with and how that has changed your perception and your abilities over the years. Has your consciousness, do you feel, have you expanded as a result?
I've expanded. Things have happened that I was a person who didn't really. I was like a friend of mine said for years, I'm as psychic as a rock, you know, and I felt that way. But I've been working with a group like in paranormal research, going to haunted sites and places where people were having disturbances, and we'd try to help them and document the activity for about 3 years. And I had tried, dabbled a little like with EVPs, never any real success. I worked with these people, Brett and Gina Oldham of Halo Paranormal, had worked with what they call a spirit box. And I realize a spirit box is like a Radio Shack most people are using. We're using it as well, a Radio Shack digital radio that has had the scanner mechanism simply deactivated where it's on continuous scan, and that's all it is. But the theory is that, you know, the spirits can use the white noise. In fact, apparently this design was brought to someone's attention by spirits who wanted to better communicate this way. So I listened the first time. I thought, I think it's just people's imagination. And, you know, I realize some of it is, but I recorded session after session to see what we were hearing, and I had an amazing experience where there was someone I had known in the writing field, John Keel, who wrote the Mothman Prophecies. I had corresponded a number of years with him and read all of his books, and we asked some questions of John because it was the one-year anniversary of his passing, and July 3rd, I think it was 2010 that we had this session, and asked him, John, what is Jadu? Well, Jadu was, he went through the Orient to India and places in Egypt, and back in the 50s when he was a young man, and this book was all about his, because he was an amateur magician, and he exposed a lot of the tricks, but there were also some things that he never did figure out what was going on. He really did believe there was a paranormal core to some of it. And anyway, the book was entitled Jadu, which was black magic in the Orient, a word for black magic. And it was telling about his adventures as he studied the beliefs and all the people and, you know, the fear they had in this magic and their abilities. So, like I say, a lot of it was explainable, but I knew that I didn't think anyone else knew that about that part about John Keel that was in the group, but I knew. And so I asked, you know, trying to find something that, you know, if this is really John Keel there, he could tell me. Said, John, what can you tell us about Jadu? And this voice comes over immediately and says, Jadu, eh? And I said, yeah, we're all like looking at each other. Brett said, Sandy Nichols says, just said it. And so I says, yeah, what can you tell us about Jadu? And the same voice says, into the fire, into the fire.
Wow.
And of course he was going in and out. We couldn't tell all what he was saying, but at one point Brett asked, what can you tell us about Bigfoot? Because he had studied a lot of reports of strange creatures, wrote extensively on the subject of Bigfoot, and this voice says, smuck Bigfoot, see? And then another voice said, see. And then another said, see. Like we had some Mexicans out there. And and so then I brought, the same night, I had some index cards, and I wrote down words. One of them was Ivan Sanderson, who was a zoologist who'd been a friend of John Keel's. I threw that down the table. I said, can they see this? Can they say this word? They did it. I did not hear it at the time, but when I played it back, there was like an Eastern Indian-type voice saying, Ivan Sanderson. And then there was, and what I heard in real time, and they did too, and they said, boy, you should have seen the expression on your face, Brent. One was M-I-B, and a male voice says, M-I-B, loud and clear. And I became a believer that night.
I tell you what, I've had an experience that wasn't like that spirit box, but I was recording because I kept hearing things. I was doing some freelance and part-time work in Sedona, Arizona, and I lived there for a while, just a short time. But there was the little drive I had to make at about 4:30 or 5 in the morning, took about 20 minutes, and I started taking a tape recorder because I would hear tapping on the window in my car. And I thought, I wanted to get it on tape. And so this one morning, and at one point I had been told telepathically to drive around a certain area. There was a lot of water on the road, and I got to work, and later on that area had been washed out, and there was an accident there later on. So I knew there's other things were happening. Anyway, I've got the tape recorder, and I'm trying to get this on tape, this tapping sound. And I say into the tape, okay, I can't hear anything. It didn't happen, but it was a good try. Well, later on, I listened to the tape, and you could hear, as I'm saying, nothing is happening. You can hear behind it. And that was what was happening as I'm saying, I can't hear. I couldn't hear a thing. But playing it back, I could. That's what's mind-blowing, is how does that happen?
Well, we started going to sites, and we were getting the words, male voice saying John Keel, which was first last name. And one day, so we actually had a lot of interactions for a while with this John Keel. And so I found an earlier, I found a tape. I was trying to figure out what all these tapes were. I hadn't marked them properly. And I stuck this one tape, cassette tape, in the recorder. I had started using digital shortly after, but this was the early on investigations, and I realized, oh, this is a spirit box. When was this? This was the first session where I didn't hear anything. So I'm just listening for a while, and there's a part where my wife was wanting to contact a brother of hers who had passed on, who they called Junior. And Brett Oldham says, okay, Junior, say your name now. At that point, I heard Keel. Now, I hadn't told anybody I wanted to contact John Keel at that time, but in my mind, I had been sending that thought out. Mm-hmm. But I never picked it up in real time, and it was months later that I found this tape. And as I listened, and I played it back, I couldn't believe this, there was a male voice that got upset with this person that said Keel, apparently, and said, and I'll just say, F you. And then you'll know what he said. But it sounded, and my wife verified it, that it sounded just like her brother's voice. And he was the one who was supposed to speak at that point, and instead, Keel came through.
Huh.
And there was another audio I did months later where, John Keel and Jesse came through on the same audio, and I said, isn't it odd? It seems like they're kind of hanging out together now. But,
those experiences, though, when you have them, it really gives you a better appreciation that there's so much going on that we can't oftentimes get it in our physical senses. We have to go back and figure out and connect the dots later on. And you just,
you know, that's sometimes hard to make that connection, that somehow I think I'm focused, I think I'm firing on all circuits, and then you go back and you listen to the tape and you hear things that you didn't hear, and they're plain as day.
Yeah. You know, people who do this, I know a lot of people go into these situations, they use the box, and then they complain, it doesn't work, and they throw it in the corner. But they don't use their recorder. You do hear things in real time, but then there's a lot of things that, unless you go back and review it, you know, you miss. And sometimes, as soon as you say it, there's an answer, but it's not that loud, and what you're hearing is some of the loud stuff that comes later, which is just the stations. Like the other night, a few nights ago, we did one, and Joan had was talking to a nephew who passed on and says, "Well, Michael, you know, I love you," and said something back like, said, "Are you there, Michael?" And says, "Yes, this is Michael." I mean, just as soon as she said it, we didn't catch it in real time, but there it was on the audio, a male voice. "This is Michael." And we've had a number of times where we got his first and last name. One time we got his first, his middle, and his last name, but the middle name, instead of being Dean like it should have been, was Drew. And I think what happens is that there's a, because sometimes we hear what we call crosstalk, where a number of people are talking about what we want to talk about, but they're talking among themselves. And we theorize that what happens sometimes is someone else steps in to carry the message to us and got his middle name wrong. I know it sounds wild. I have to pinch myself sometimes to realize, this actually happened. And, you know, it happened to me.
Yeah, well, and if you're listening, check out the website and some of the stories, because there's so much there. I mean, you've done such a great job of giving all across the board different accounts of people who just have different perspectives and experiences with reality. We're going to have to wrap up. I want to go back to that Kreskin interview, because there were several parts that he brings. One is about hypnosis, and that he believes there's no such thing as hypnosis. I thought that was really telling. And then there's another part where he brings the UFO content into the equation, and he's, you know, these, you would think if anybody had a clue, somebody who's telepathic and somebody who's a mentalist, he might have a better perspective on all of this stuff. I like the way that he says there's no such thing as hypnosis, and we really have no idea how suggestible and how powerful we are with our thoughts. That's a clue to how he works, really.
Yeah, I think that in that interview, you kind of get a glimpse of what our true potential could be, but it's hard because, you know, a lot of us are already kind of set in our ways, you know. It's hard to go back and change that, because, you know, those formative years where those kind of things develop more easily have passed. But, there's still hope. I mean, we can still do a little of it and make some improvement, but it's not quite like the start that Kreskin got on it, you know, I feel like.
Well, what he says at the end, the element of suggestibility is a part of what we believe and how we are acting in our lives. And so if we have the capacity, what he says, to experience an idea and we suggest it to ourselves, we can lock our thinking in so that consequently we can make it happen. And that is powerful. And it sounds simplistic. It sounds, there has to be more to it. And that's the deal. It's so simple, it works.
Right. And I know that Dr. Schwartz was certainly very impressed with Kreskin, and there were other people that he knew who were similar to Kreskin, like a Joseph Dunninger, who was sort of like a mentalist, who also claimed to have strong telepathic abilities, and you can read about that in his book Psychic Nexus. And you know, there are people who are really examples of this potential that exists. And like you say, he really gives us some insight into how it can be cultivated, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Now, if you're wanting to find out more, the magazine covers everything from UFO to individual contact to interviews with people who names you might recognize, and all across the board. If you are metaphysically oriented or interested or have aspirations to develop your own abilities and see what everybody else is talking about, check out the website. What would you like to, we're going to have to wrap up here. Is there anything you would suggest? I mean, you have all these wonderful interviews and book reviews and that kind of thing. What's right now you think the most maybe pertinent?
Well, right now we
best content.
They might want to check out the Kreskin interview itself that we've just posted and been talking about, we have all our issues going back. Way back years ago, are archived on our site. They come out once a month, so each issue has an interview feature and has an Archaeo Trek column, Encounters with the Unknown, Classic Mysteries, My Reality Checking feature, book reviews, and so there's something for everyone who has an alternate perception.
Well, and even people who've had their own experiences. In your letters to the editor, there's one there talking about a woman who had a full-blown apparition experience or encounter.
Well, actually, a man that had that, Sandy Nichols, that's a man.
Okay, sorry.
But,
whoops, correction.
He gets that sometimes. But yeah, he lives up in near Nashville, Thompson Station, Tennessee, and he's an alien abductee and ghost hunter, and he has lots of, his home is very haunted. Sometimes we just go ahead and have our investigation at his home, which is a real nice house, and we have all the creature comforts there and kick back. He has a swimming pool and jacuzzi, you know.
Invite the ghost to show up, right?
Yeah.
We know y'all are here. Okay, who wants to talk tonight? It's your game.
Yeah, that's where... you know, where that we've had several fantastic spirit box sessions. That's where the one there was John Keel first started, Jay Du, and Smuck Bigfoot and all this. And one of the things that surprised me was the spirits speak whatever's on their mind. They're not worried about FCC rules and regulations. They use some awful language. But then, as someone said, hey, you know, a lot of people on this side use the bad language too. And I noticed in Susie Smith's Voices of the Dead back in, I think, 1977, which was about EVPs, she mentioned about a lot of people getting four-letter words. So apparently this is not anything new, and, you know, it's just something that kind of surprised me. So if anybody does this work, that sometimes is your most convincing evidence, because, you know, they're coming out with this awful language through your radio, you know.
Yes, yeah, and it's like, okay, why can't we just get beyond that? But yeah, that it does kind of. I think it just basically gets your attention, and I really think that's a shock value of, are you really paying attention, and how far do you want to go with this? We're down to a minute. I want to thank you for giving us your time, and I really, really enjoy the articles that you are sharing with your magazine and your website.
Well, thank you, Wendy, and I appreciate you having me on, and I've enjoyed sharing what I could of about Kreskin and the Peruvian whistles and everything else we've had time to talk about. And thank you very much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And if you're listening, go ahead and check out Alternate Perceptions Magazine. It's apmagazine.info for all the details. I'm Wendy Garrett. You can find out more on my shows, Conscious Living, on Empower Radio. Have a great night, great day, great time, wherever you are, and take care. See ya.